petition number 16808, Rule 14.
Great Spittles, Rule 14.
Yes, so the situation was that the 3rd Royal Tanks had been up on the hill supporting the infantry because they used to take it in turns, apparently, the brigade, the three regiments in the brigade, the 2nd Fife and 4th Yeomanry, 23rd Hussars and the 3rd Royal Tanks. I suppose you couldn't expect one to be taking all the casualties, so that, I suppose they would take it in turns in rotation of some sort. But anyway, this didn't involve us because we were giving protection to the 4th Armoured Brigade on the flanks. But this particular night, the 3rd Tanks needed to be withdrawn, and Germans were very good at sort of sussing things out. And obviously, Pip Roberts thought, I mean, this is what I've thought since the war, actually. I mean, at the time, you just do what you're told and you don't sort of think any depth into the reasoning of it. But I've thought about it since the war, and when they was we were instructed, again, I don't know whether C Squadron were involved or not, I speak for myself and my squadron, we were instructed to go up the side of Hill 112 and enable the 3rd Tanks to withdraw, and in the case of any sort of a counter-attack coming in while this was going on, we could be used to offset it. Anyway, I've had different thoughts about this since the war. Our tanks are rather noisy compared to Sherman's, and in the dark noise is accentuated. You can hear things at night in the dark that you can't hear in the daytime under the same circumstances. And so I've thought since that was a very good move on Pip Roberts's way to get the 3rd Tanks off, because with the noise of us going up and taking up positions, the Germans would hear our Cromwells, and by now the Germans knew what Cromwells were anyway, the noise what they made, and so it would be possible for the noise of us going in would cover the noise of the 3rd Tanks coming out. And then we, having assumed our positions, would shut down and switch off in the dark so we couldn't be located by the noise. And we would sit there, which we did, and the 3rd Tanks quietly withdrew. And we were in that situation for possibly 2 hours, probably getting on for 3 hours. You're not very well aware of time, really. And then we were withdrawn in the dark, and nothing happened. I mean, we didn't become involved in any shooting or anything. But I've thought since the war, you know, that it's a very good move on Pitt Roberts's move, because the Germans, hearing us move up, would wonder what was happening. Why were these fresh tanks being brought in? Was there going to be an attack at first light supported by more tanks than they probably knew were already there? And did this probably stop the Germans from mounting a counterattack, thinking that the opposition would be greater than they thought it might be? Where in actual fact, there were no tanks there at all when we withdrew, because the 3rd Tanks had gone and we withdrew, and all that would be there would be the infantry with the anti-tank guns. And then we resumed our normal daylight occupation, which was protecting the flanks of the 4th Armoured Brigade at that time, who was supporting elements of the 15th Scottish, what you might say on level ground, down at Bretavillette and Belleville Farm and Grainville. In that area, the 15 Scottish elements of it were in that area, Grainville and Bretavillette. They were supported by the 4th Armoured Brigade, and our two squadrons were protecting the two flanks of the 4th Armoured Brigade, with A Squadron on the right flank and C Squadron on the left flank, during the daytime, you see. Well, then, that's the only time I can have a sort of a good recollection of any incident over those few days, because it seemed a sort of an ongoing messy sort of a situation. And although we were fighting Germans and getting the old tank knocked out and all this, that and the other, there was nothing that I recall of a serious nature other than that one incident after the first episode at Shur. And this particular night, that was the day, the 29th of June, the daytime, we'd been occupying, let's say, the right flank of the 4th Armoured Brigade, protecting them. And again, it was an upward slope up to a village. Unfortunately, I can't quite recall the name now, I found. It's a funny name. And the Germans were occupying the high ground, and we were on the slope up to it, you see. But we were not instructed to take the ridge. Our idea was to contain the Germans from coming off of it. And they were obviously feeling that they were containing us from taking it, which we had no intention of doing. That wasn't their job, you see. Our job was to be there in case the Germans made an attack, which we would supposedly contain. Anyway, the day wore on, and I don't remember that anything particularly happened except these skirmishes. We'd have a shoot at somebody, they'd have a shoot at us, and nothing serious happened. And the evening came on, and what used to happen then, the armour used to be withdrawn to replenish ammunition and supplies and everything else, petrol or whatever. And then either you would return and take up positions of defence, probably in support of infantry or whatever, or alternatively, your liaison officer would find what was known as a harbour that you would go into for the night to bed down and sit there for the night, you see. It didn't mean to say that you'd probably get any sleep. It just meant that you were in an area where the higher authorities knew you were, so that they could use you when any time they wanted, you see. They had to know where you were. And so you could just sit there through the night, do nothing. You sit there dozing, half and half asleep, not getting any proper sleep, and the next day you carry on as normal, you see, hoping to try and keep awake. Anyway, the night came on, and we were withdrawn, our two squadrons, and we'd ammoed up and petrolled up and everything. And I should think it was by now about 10 o'clock to half past 10. And the 4th Armoured Brigade also disengaged and pulled back to do the same thing, to replenish anything they needed to replenish. Unfortunately, whether the Germans were aware of this, I don't know. But they put in a counterattack. And this was about 11 o'clock at night. And the Scottish infantry blokes, they got anti-tank guns and such, but after the initial fighting started, they soon suss out the situation and the ferocity or density of the enemy incoming fire. And they decided that they were not going to be able to contain it as they were, and they wanted the tanks back. Well, the 4th Armoured Brigade apparently were not in a situation to be able to do that. And somebody decided that our two squadrons would be quite adequate in this sort of sudden emergency to go to the 15th Scottish, put ourselves at their disposal, and hold the situation until the whole situation could be reassessed and re-sorted. Well, our squadron, A squadron, was to go down this road from a little town called Haute de Bosch, which was about a mile and a half further on than Shur. And so we were in the vicinity of this other little town, Haute de Bosch. And A squadron were to use the road that went from there down to Retavillette. And C squadron were to go down the left flank on a road that went from Haute de Bosch down to Grainville. At a point on each one of these lines of approach, we were given a point where, in the case of A Squadron, we would turn left because we would be on the right flank of the infantry situation. C Squadron would do their thing and turn in right, so that the two squadrons that had come in, if correctly done, behind the infantry on both sides, and then the infantry would tell you where they wanted you to be according to what they assessed the situation to be, you see. Well, we start off, and as I say, we're talking of about 11 o'clock turning at night in the dark, when, as you can imagine, tanks are totally blind, you're not using any lights, and we start off down this road in a column. I assume HQ troop were in the front, and we were somewhere, as I recall, in the centre of this column of the squadron of 18 to 20 tanks. And we go down this road, and we knew from the daytime exploitation that we'd been doing that initially we were in amongst sunken roads. It was a sunken road, but suddenly burst out into totally open land. Both sides were open country and no banks, no high banks. And on the left, as we came out, initially the right side of us became flat and open first. The left-hand side was still trees, and suddenly that stopped, and there was a belt of thick trees going across from the road away to the left in the darkness, and then both sides of the road were open country, and we are motoring down, and suddenly we start getting fired on in the dark. There's tracers flying across, and quite heavy, you know, quite a concentrated fire, and what they could see to fire at, I don't know. Whether they felt they could see us sufficiently to fire, unless they were just firing across at a given height, thinking, well, if it's anything gets in the way, it'll hit it. Well, when you have a conference and details are given, you're always given one instruction, and that is, in the situation where we're going to be in, if it was necessary for us to abandon the line of approach and scatter in the dark, they give you a point where you can reassemble, a map reference or something like that. You see, in the dark, it's got to be a map reference. You can't see nothing to give you an object. So we're given this map reference to rendezvous in the dark if we have to scatter, you see, and the operation is aborted. And this is what happened. Bobby Peel decides that this incoming fire was too heavy for us to proceed any further. So he decides, he gives the code word, and we scatter in the dark and basically become isolated individual tanks. We rendezvous back under your own steam at this map reference, and it becomes obvious that the point for gathering up is this thick belt of trees that ran across from the road to the left. So the situation becomes then, after about half an hour, that you've got a line of tanks along this belt of trees, all mixed up as regards troops. We're not in troops anymore. There's a tank on my right, there's a tank on my left, but not necessarily my troop, you see. It could be anybody's troop. So there you have the line of tanks across the front of this belt of trees, all mixed up, and it transpires that only one tank had been hit, and this happened to be Mr. Lowinger, and it hit the turret of his tank and he was killed, and his body was still in the turret. Well, there's nothing they could do about that at the moment. They couldn't sort of heave his body out or anything like that, so it was decided that the tank would stay in and go in action in the column, and that's what we was intending to do. Now, Bobby Peel asked permission at this time for our squadron to change over and use C Squadron's line of approach because they at this moment had not had any contact with the enemy. So he thought the obvious thing was at least we could get to the 15th Scottish by using C Squadron's line of approach, even if we came in on the wrong place. I mean, that could be sorted out afterwards. But they decided, the higher authority, that we must approach on that same line of march. So Bobby Peel said, right, now, to get up on the road, we couldn't just go up on the road higgledy-piggledy, we've got to be organised. So he said, HQ troop will start up their engines and go up onto the road. Now, there's four tanks in HQ troop, but there's only three in each of the other four fighting troops, you see. He said, so HQ troop will start up and go up onto the road, and as soon as the last tank of HQ troop passes the right-hand stationary tank in the line in front of the trees, that tank will start his engine up, identify himself on the B set to his other two tanks, and move out and get up onto the road. That meant you've got three tanks would pull out of the column, well, the right-hand one would pull out, and the other two, wherever they were, his companions, would pull out, turn right, and those three tanks would go up on the road. So you've now created another individual right-hand tank. Again, he would identify himself, and his other two companion tanks, wherever they were in the line, would pull out, and those three tanks would then go up and get up onto the road. And that way, Bobby Peel got the whole squadron back on the road in troops, but not necessarily in the same order of troops as they were the first time, you see. Now, he didn't wait for the whole squadron to become on the road before they moved off in a column. As soon as HQ got up on the road, they moved off. And the next troop that got up on the road, they moved off. Well, it so happened that my troop, number two troop, was the last troop to get up on the road. And I became the leading tank of my troop, with Mr. Hobson behind me and Sergeant Jackman behind him on the road. But nobody in front of us, because they'd all gone, you see. So we start off down the road, and in the dark, the driver can't see very far. So if an object comes up in front of you, he stands on his tillers and stops as quick as he can, but it usually means that you're tucked up to whatever is in front of you. And in this instance, it was a Cromwell tank that had been abandoned on the road. And because we were tight up to it, I didn't know for whatever reason it was, so I jumped out of my turret onto the back of this Cromwell and ascertained that it was empty. There was nobody in it. Why it was there, I don't know. The engine wasn't running, and it just stood there. So I gets back in, reports to Mr. Robson that it was an isolated Cromwell tank, which he could see anyway, in the dark. But there was nobody in it, and appeared to be nobody. Like, the crew were not in the ditch at the side of the road or anything. They did not seem to be in the vicinity. So where the crew had gone, I don't know. So Mr. Robson says, right, well, hold firm where you are. I'm going to reverse, that was Mr. Robson, and pass you and the stationary tank and carry on. And then you will be able to pull back because he's not there, you see. And then I can pass this tank and carry on. Well, this confirmed to me what I'd always thought in training and was becoming apparent in my own opinion. I mean, anybody else might have their own opinions, but I had got my own, that Mr. Hobson, in an emergency, got a panic on. He got nervous. And the fact that we had become isolated from the rest of the squadron, he wanted to get to the squadron, to be with the squadron, instead of controlling his own troop. Because as soon as he passed me, he carried on. He didn't stop and wait. He carried on. I thought, well, that's bloody stupid. but it put me in the position of now being able to reverse and do the same. Well, as we're doing this, Bill Bagley, my operator, kicked me under the doona, and I said, "What's up?" He said, "Bobby Pearl's come up," mm-hmm. and he said, "Whoever's tank is the last tank in the column is to turn around and go back and pick up any survivors, walking, wounded, whatever." Now, by the time our troop got up on the road, there were already tanks burning down in a little hamlet that was down the road. There was a crossroad down the road and a little conglomeration of a big farm and a few cottages, like a little hamlet, you see. And the head of our column had already stopped, and there were tanks burning before we'd even got on the road with my troop. And so, as from now on, Bobby Pearl said that, you see, so Jackman must have stopped where he was. If it had turned around and went back then, he wouldn't have picked anybody up, because there was nobody walking up the roads. It was only when I passed the stationary tank and carried on to join the squadron that we now started to pass people walking up the road. Some were wounded, helping each other, some were just walking. And it looked just like, almost like infantry, patrol, you know, individuals walking up the road, walking back. And I carried on. And I mean, you didn't really recognise anybody in the dark, but you know they were your blokes. And when we gets down to the this little hamlet, there was a big building on the left, like as if it was the side of a big barn or something. It was very, very long and high, got a roof on, and the little slits in the side that they put in for ventilation and that sort of thing. And running out of this open ground, the bank went up, and we came in between a high bank on the right and this big building on the left. And in the dark, I noticed there was a big stone monolith about 5 feet tall embedded in the bank. It was probably a mileage thing, you know, like a milestone or something. It would have something on it. And in Normandy, you found a lot of these monoliths, about 5 feet tall, and they were stuck in the banks, you know, with some information on them, like kilometres to so-and-so or something like that. And you knew they were there, but you didn't stop and read them, like, you know. And I observed, because by now we're getting to the crossroads, and the Germans are putting up these flares and star shells and all that, and then there's fire going on, there's several tanks burning further down the road. So you were getting a sort of a intermittent light and then darkness all the time. So you could begin to sort of take stock of the area, what was around you, you see. So I was aware that there was this monolith as I passed it, a high bank on the right, a big building on the left. And we're coming to the crossroads, which was under mortar fire. And as we approach it, we naturally slowed down because we could see the tanks further on, quarter of a mile down the other side of the crossroads. And this mortar fire seemed to be coming in batches, as though they put perhaps about a dozen, and then there seemed to be a gap, and then another batch would come over. So naturally I said to Benny, Bill Benmore, my driver, I said, shut all down, Benny, I said, and when the next gap comes, nip across, you see, in the hopes that we get over in the gap. As it happened, we did. Well, he naturally puts a spurt on to go across, so he's doing a good speed. And before I can open my flaps and get my head out again, he comes to a stop, the tank standing on its nose in the dark, you see, and he stops, and we're tucked up right behind a Cromwell, which was in front. And that was Mr. Hobson, obviously, because he was the last one that went down the road. So I jumps on the back of his tank, and we have a little conversation about the situation. And there's the squadron tanks down this, with a bank either side, a high bank either side, and it appeared the right-hand bank appeared to be bushes or an orchard of some sort, but the left-hand bank appeared to be an open field. I'm describing this because of subsequent actions what follow. Now, I'll have a conversation with Mr. Robson. He can't offer any solution to the situation because we're just at the end of a column of tanks that can't move anywhere. As tanks burning down further down the road, and this might seem strange to a normal person, but I said, well, I'll go down, I'll have a walk down and see if I can see what's happening. I could see what was happening, but I wanted a bit more information than what I could see. So I gets down, and of course I'd already informed my crew, you see, that I was going to get out, so they knew that I wasn't there, and the tank wouldn't move till I came back. So I jumps down and walks down the road past the side of the Air Cromwells, which had got crews in them, and all stationary. I walked by about four or five, and by now I can see the head of the column is in a right shambles. There's Jerry's dashing about in the dark in the firelight and the flares that are going up and all that, and all this racket's going on, you see. And I thought, well, no point going any further. I can see that it's a shambles. In my own mind, thinking, oh, what the bloody hell's going to happen now? You know, you couldn't see that the squadron could move. They got these two eye banks, one either side, with the orchard or whatever it was on the right hand side, and an open field on the other, and all the tanks were almost touching each other. The tanks were longer than the road was wide. They couldn't turn round. I thought, Christ, what a bloody situation. So I runs back, climbs upon Mr. Robson's tank, and I said, it's a bit of a shambles down there. I said, I don't know what the bloody hell is going to happen. He said, I'll tell you what's happening. He said, it's all finished. He said, Bobby Poole's been up, and he said, the action's finished, and everybody look out of themselves and the best of luck. I said, oh, right. So he said, you better shift your tank so I can back up, you see. Now, the situation then becomes, what are you going to do? Are you going to back up, right up to the crossroads, or try to take up the bank? It was a very steep bank, you see. And I thought, well, you can't back up to the crossroads, you're going to get mortared, you see. And that's the only place you could turn round. You've got to go right back to the crossroads before you could turn round. And the thing about a Cromwell, it was the only tank other than a Churchill tank that had the facility to do what is known as a neutral turn. A normal tank, if you want to turn it round, you pull one tiller or the other to lock the track. And you're in gear and you rev up and you drive forward and do what is known as a skid turn. That is by holding one tank, one track solid so it can't move. The other track is mobile, so it drives and drives the tank round to the left or right according to whichever track you're locking, you see. But you don't do a tight turn. You don't actually spin on your axis. Even though you lock the track solid by pulling a tiller hard on, the fact that the other track is driving round, the tank will still move slightly forward and off its centre point, you see. So you're not actually doing a spin turn like spinning on a tanner. But with a Cromwell and a Churchill, you could do what is known as a neutral turn. And to do that, you used to put the gearbox in neutral, pull the opposite tiller to whichever way you wanted to go. If you wanted the nose to point to the right, you pull the left tiller. If you wanted the nose to point to the left, you pull the right tiller. Now, having decided which way you wanted the nose to turn, you then pull the tiller, appropriate tiller, rev the engine up, and what used to happen, the two tracks would go round in reverse to each other. So one track would go backwards, and the other track would go forwards. So the fact that the one track is going in reverse and the other track is going forward means that you stand still, literally, and spin like a top on a point. And when the nose gets to the angle that you want to drive off in, the driver puts his tiller forward, what we call makes the tiller again, and you carry on driving as a normal tank, having turned left or right on your own axis. You haven't moved a foot forward or a foot backward. You've turned completely on your own axis by doing a neutral turn. And at that time of the war, the Churchill tank and the Cromwell tank were the only two tanks that could do that. You see, so anyway, that meant that we'd got to go back to the crossroads and do a neutral turn to turn round. And obviously, we wasn't going to get away without being mortared.